It reminds me of your last year's happiness episode and listening to it and doing the transcript for it and thinking, wow, that was so optimistic.
Well, I think this is actually that's a great point and a great lead-in for today's episode, because we are talking about shit. We are talking about poop, defecation, things that most people don't really want to talk about or think about. And we know it's been a tough year, but you know, it's funny because while the happiness in the good life, according to the Aztecs, was a more unabashedly optimistic episode, there's actually a lot of interesting, positive thinking that can come out of how we deal with shit and poop. So I think you actually just gave us the perfect intro right there.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to This Anther Life. It's really exciting to be here. This is Adam Gamwell, and I am joined today. I'm very excited to have my colleague, Liz Smythe, joining us. Liz, how you doing?
Great. How are you?
Doing pretty well. I'm excited to talk about shit.
Yeah, me too.
Liz has been working in interning with This Anther Life for the latter part of the year 2020, which has been awesome. So good things can come out of tough years, as we're saying. And you've probably recognized her work in expanding our transcripts that we have offering now. We're adding them to every episode. And her work with show notes, as well as she's done some really great original essays in our new Voice and Value blog, which we have show notes and links to, as always. As we were kind of opening up here, it's been a difficult year, as we know, 2020. Like some would say, it's been downright shitty, as it were. Yet, it's the end of the year, and oftentimes people like to think about New Year's resolutions, and they want to expel the bad things of the past year and pick up great new practices for the next and upcoming year, preparing for what's next. And that kind of got us thinking about what would be an appropriate episode that's kind of an end of the year send-off, that something about happiness and the good life are important, but it felt a little weird for 2020, given how it's been. And so we thought about going into the other end of things, and raising the question about how we deal with shit is a little bit about how we deal with challenges more generally, right? And so we wanted to explore the question of what does shit tell us about ourselves and how we deal with it? And what are the ways that we solve problems and think about dealing with defecation and things like health and sanitation? What does it tell us about how we want to solve problems and make the world a better place? Liz and I have been talking back and forth about how do we think about these ideas, right? And part of it, of course, is where do these words come from? And so I'd love to share a little bit of a story about where the word shit comes from. And Liz, I'm curious, do you know where this word comes from or why we use this term?
No, I don't, which is kind of odd. You would think you would, but I don't. I'd love to know.
Right. It's one of those words that we use a lot, you know, and as of right now, I don't know. I think I just saw on Netflix that Nicolas Cage has a History of Curse Words new show. So I haven't watched it yet. So he may have an episode on this. So maybe Nicolas Cage can help inform us, like on all things, I suppose. This also might be something of an urban legend. I'm not really sure. But the idea is that during the Industrial Revolution, a little bit past, when manure was a very commonly used source of fuel for burning and for heat, they would, you know, collect it from farms and cattle out in pastures, and then they would load it up on trains and then send it across to different states or different cities where they needed fuel for burning things. Now, one of the main things we probably know about cow manure in general, or sheep manure or farm manure, is that feces releases methane. And methane not only smells bad, but it's flammable. And so what would happen is that they would put these piles of manure into train cars. And if there was traveling across, you know, think about the American Southwest or anywhere just kind of in the middle part of the country, and it's hot and dry. And so then a spark would happen or something, and then the train would explode. That's bad. You lose a train. And this is because, again, all the methane would get built up and captured. And so what folks started doing is they were devising a scheme to store the shit higher in the train, so that way it would be able to vent out the methane, but then they could store things below it too if they needed to. So basically just like building a second tier or higher on cars. So on the actual cars themselves, they apparently would write SHIT, which was an acronym for store high in train, so that the methane would have ability to escape out the top without getting captured below everything. So that's the urban legend of where the word shit comes from.
Wow, that's actually really interesting. I can't believe that's an acronym. And now we use it as a word. That's so interesting.
Right? I know. Like we got lazy.
Yeah, I know. We got lazy from it. It makes me think about how we say like something stinks. We might use the word PU, you know, more like Pepe Le Pew kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
It actually came from an ancient exclamation at saying something is rotten and stinking. Huh. Yeah, isn't that so interesting? Like, it's from the stem putrid and putrefy.
That makes well.
Yeah. It's so interesting to me that we have these very ancient, or maybe even not so ancient with the Industrial Revolution, ideas about what something, the smell of something gross, like shit, or the literal word shit, and how that came from an acronym.
Yeah. It's funny because one of the questions we want to tackle here is, what does poop tell us about culture in ourselves as being humans, right? Because it's obviously an awkward thing to talk about. Like, I almost want to have a counter of how many times we say the word shit or poop during this episode, just because it's like, you don't often talk about it. However, one of the things that inspired this episode, besides this being like a difficult year, was that I ran across this article the other day that was published in Wired, that was an excerpt from a book by Harold McGee that was called Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. And it was just about how, like, the story of poop is actually the story of human technology. And I had never really thought about that before, you know. But then, of course, if we're thinking about, like, the word shit being part of a train, or like in relationship to moving things around industrially, or even this Indo-European root of the word poo, or as part of a word, when we think of things that are rotten, it's like, in how we even think about shit is built into the way that we deal with technological change and even how we express things, you know? So I think that's quite interesting. And there's a lot there. Obviously, I found this quote that I want to read that to me is like perfectly encapsulating a graduate school level writing anthropology, but it's an entire essay about poop worlds by Shaka McLaughlin and Scott Weibel. And what they say is that it's possessed of a vibrant materiality that confuses the categories of life and death. It crisscrosses the intimacies of public and private, bodies institutional and fleshy, in subterranean networks of sewers and everyday taboos. There's a lot that's happening in this quote, but I really like this, especially this idea of bodies institutional and fleshy. It confuses the categories of life and death, right? It crisscrosses both public and private. What does this quote evoke in your mind?
Wow, that's a good question. It's such an interesting way to talk about poop. To me, it's so, like you said, it's very academic and kind of very anthropology, if that's the way to put it. I thought it's interesting. It says it crisscrosses the intimacies of public and private, and how the ideas and taboos around poop have changed. You know, long ago, we used to probably poop in pretty open areas or together. And that's still the case in some places as well. It's not usually the case in Western society, but even like George Washington's house, he has a double like person, like two people could be in his outhouse at the same time. And I think about that and think about that wasn't quite that long ago, although it was, but you know, that's not something you would associate with a president of the United States, right? And that's just kind of interesting to me. Maybe nowadays we might, I don't know.
You got to take a meeting, right? You got to take a meeting.
Yeah. You have really important information. You got to bring your friend with you. I don't know. You don't want to be alone. Any of that.
Okay. I didn't know that. That's super interesting. So there's a double team, a team toilet, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's a perfect example of how to draw on this quote too, that it like crisscrosses this public and private, right? That it's like both a private act, but then you're there with a teammate or a friend. I don't know, maybe an antagonist, depending on what you're trying to go for. But then also it's public in a very interesting way because it's the president's house also.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
It's a matter of state. And so I think what's really interesting about this example with George Washington that you bring up too, is that it points out to the idea that animal excrement in general, like both, you know, humans or animals, obviously, is that we're generally disgusted by seeing a pile of dog shit on the sidewalk or a horse shit in a street, or obviously human shit is even worse almost, right? But what Harold McGee points out in his book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells, is that apparently this reaction of disgust that we have is actually something that we're learned, we're taught culturally. It's not necessarily an automatic biological reflex that we don't want to be near or around shit. If you look at different apes, chimpanzees or gorillas, you may see them either using excrement as a weapon by throwing it at somebody else, but then oftentimes you'll see them smelling it too as forms of identification of knowing who somebody is. And humans are just weird in the ape community because we don't do that. Neither every other animal you'll see, you know, dogs are known for sniffing butts, or cats will do the same thing. Or a cat will show you its butt because it's friendly and it's saying to you like, hey, just this is who I am. Humans would never do that, right? But it's funny because we tend to have this idea that somehow it's naturally disgusting to even think about or deal with poop. But then most other animals, that's like one way of identification. Even there's ideas of rabbits will eat their poop and they kind of digest their food twice. Again, that sounds gross to us, but they actually get nutrients in a slightly different way because their digestive juices have broken down the food in a slightly different way. These are things we don't really think too much about this, but when we look again across even species too, we realize that poop is actually such an important part about life and in some cases identification and culture, right? Of how we identify and communicate with others. So it's interesting to then think about the George Washington example, because to us it sounds quite strange to have a team toilet. But if you don't have the same kind of taboo, like you can't poop near somebody or you can't be near them when you're going to the bathroom, then it's almost, if you think about it, it's actually perfectly rational to that's a great place to meet because you got to be sit down for a few minutes anyway. So why not have a meeting? And so I don't know, there's something interesting about that, right? It's a learned behavior, I think, versus we are immediately abhorred by it. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, that is an interesting thing to bring up because, yes, of course, we as humans tend to shy away from, we think it's taboo to be around poop or excrement of any type. And it is interesting that our ape cousins don't feel the same way. It's interesting, I wonder why they use it as a weapon if they feel it's not necessarily gross. That's interesting. That's something I don't know. I'd love to know about that. Why is it a weapon?
That's a good question. Yeah. Like, you know, the example of a chimpanzee throwing poop at either people that they're visiting or other chimpanzees, maybe just because it's a readily accessible thing you can throw, you know, it might be as simple as, I don't know. So if any biological anthropologists are listening, hit us up and let us know. thisanthrolife@gmail.com. Let us know, why are chimpanzees throwing poo versus sticks and stones? You know, something else that is interesting about this is the conundrum of to sit or to squat, right? How does somebody go to the bathroom? We live in the United States, and though we live on different coasts, we have the same kinds of toilets, as far as we know. I've never been to your house, but I assume that you also have a Western toilet that you can sit on.
Yes.
and I bet most people listening also have one of those, right? You may have a squat toilet if you have an outhouse in the back of your yard or something, but we've been sitting on porcelain toilets for a while now. I mean, the flush toilet itself was invented in the 16th century, which is interesting, by Sir John Harrington, but really only became mass produced and used by the masses in the 19th century. So it's not even, I mean, about 200 years, it's not super long we've been sitting, but it's really interesting just to think about this as a way that we have chosen culturally to sit. And if you've never thought about this before, still today, actually, and you pointed this out before, Liz, that in a lot of places around the world, squat toilets are the norm, right? You see this in India, you see this in large parts of South America. When I lived in Peru and I was hanging out on farms with farmers, most of the time they would have an outhouse with a squat toilet. And it actually took a little time to get used to it, but there's scientific research that it's actually a little bit better for you to squat than it is to sit. And this has to do with the way that our bowels and our muscles are configured down south, in that when you're sitting, your sphincter muscles are not entirely able to be relaxed, but when you're squatting, they are. And if you've only been sitting in toilets for 200-ish years, maybe a little longer, they may have had medieval privies where you can sit down, but for the most part, you'd be squatting over a pot or the ground. And it's not because we were lacking a toilet to sit on, but that's actually just the way that we normally would defecate or go to the bathroom. So that's interesting to contemplate that we have what we consider to be a modern amenity in terms of a sit toilet. It is nice to have a flushing toilet. There's no question about, like, it feels cleaner that way, at least to us, right? But it's not necessarily better for us in terms of our biology. And so even just recognizing how a culture will shape the literal way that we go to the bathroom. And it's not necessarily just a question of, like, is it more sanitary to have a flush toilet versus being able to go into a hole in the ground if you have a squat toilet, but really also, again, like, what is actually better or good for us in our bodies, right? And I was going to say, I can't ask you about, have you tried a squat toilet?
It's just interesting how culture, we usually think of culture as divorced from biology, but really it's so interconnected. You know, we define what we do biologically. I mean, we have biological needs like eating and defecating, but we define how we do them, what we eat, how we defecate, where we defecate, all of the above.
Yeah, meaning that, like, we're never just purely at the whims of our biology, right? We can obviously shape them in multiple different ways. And even to contemplate what that means in our past selves too, because archaeology, obviously, like there's the study of coprolites, which is the study of human shit or animal shit too. But even that, we can study fossilized poo as a way to understand what ancient diets were like and how people's health was. We can't necessarily see how they went to the bathroom, you know, unless there's a toilet maybe, or a squat toilet, we can see that, right? But culture shapes everything that we do in terms of the kinds of things that we think we should eat, how we should use the bathroom, how we should defecate, right? Something that seems so, that is so basic biology that we have to do it, but how we do it and where we do it, right? Are we in a room by ourselves? The colonial British had this idea in colonial Africa. There was this not nice discourse that Britons thought that Africans would just kind of defecate recklessly and that they needed to have a more clean sanitary idea of going to the bathroom. And so this is actually where we saw the name of the wash closet come up too, that they need to build latrines, a hole in the ground, and then a concrete slab over it with four walls. And that becomes the wash closet, as it were, they called it. But even this idea too, that culturally, you know, how one group, especially when there's unequal power at play, thinks that something should be, you know, what is cleaner, like this is the proper way or improper way to go to the bathroom, which I think we know that the British are famous for having the ideas of propriety, but all cultures have it really. And then trying to impose that also on different groups of people. And so it's interesting to even see that in the level of defecation, right? And we see this not super differently today, even if we're talking about developing versus developed nations, and that, I mean, there are UN-led sanitary and public health programs that are about building in latrines and ending open defecation is what they call it in rural areas across the world, because there is public health concerns about just having shit out there. Like if somebody has intestinal parasite, it may come out in their shit and somebody steps in it, they could catch it and pass it along. But also then just the idea of again, what does it mean to be sanitary? And at least acknowledging that there are power differentials too that come in with what counts as sanitary and what's the safe thing to do and what's the best way to use the toilet. All this to come back and say that the most basic of biological acts is laden with power, is laden with culture, and how we do it and when we do it and with whom we do it or not. It's all these big kind of cultural parts. We don't often, you know, find ourselves contemplating the life in the toilet bowl, but it is quite a complex space, I think, you know.
So thinking about poop and COVID-19, because of course we can't do an episode about 2020 and not mention COVID-19. That would be insane, wouldn't it? Yeah. But it's interesting, as Adam pointed out earlier, we can find out a lot about our health from our stool samples and from sewage as well. And that's what some scientists have been doing to monitor the COVID-19 outbreak, because you can see it in stool samples earlier than people who are presenting symptoms or in people who don't present symptoms at all as well. And we can see where COVID-19 is highly congregating. So 140 universities and places with congregate living, like nursing homes or homeless shelters, are surveilling their wastewater and to quickly and passively just assess risk and see where they can allocate their resources, see where they need, you know, what cities need more hospital beds, what cities need more ventilators, down to that kind of stuff. But also, where do we need more testing? Where do we need more masks?
I feel like this has probably been a very common practice for scientists and medical researchers for a while, but it's interesting how it almost takes on a new need and a new level of help. Just like if we focus on wastewater and excretion as something that we can measure at a building level, that we can get a sense of where are higher levels of risk. Because obviously this has huge implications, like if there's shortages of testing or it takes a lot more work to go test, you know, every single person. If there's a nursing home with 300 people or a dorm, right, that has 1,000 students in it, it's a ton of work to go test every single one of them. But then it's like, if you can get a vision at the water level or at the waste level, right, of what the potential level of COVID is or other kind of pathogens, then you know where to put your money at risk. I think that that's super interesting. This is how we can solve problems with shit, right? It's not just about trying to get rid of it, but it's actually, since it's a part of us, or it was, you know, there's much that we can learn from it in terms of how we can improve our own health and allocation of resources. It's kind of cool because the flip side of this is not only does poop come out of us, but it can actually come back into us in with fecal transplants, for example. And this is something that I think is super fascinating. And both, it's funny, I don't particularly feel grossed out by it. If you have an immune issue and you live with someone or live near them, you'll have sort of similar biomes in your gut and your biota. And so if you're ill and you're missing some bacteria that you need, but your partner has it, for example, you can get a fecal transplant. You know, they would take some of their feces, they would dry it out, obviously. Usually put it in pill capsule, and then you can eat it. And then it actually helps repopulate your gut flora. It's genius, right? It's just like we have these built-in storage systems almost in that we can then use them to heal ourselves. And others, to me, it's just kind of cool that you can download some healthy bacteria this way.
Absolutely. I agree. I think it's so interesting how our gut biomes are our second brain, how what's going on in our gut affects everything in our body. And it's so interesting that you can have a fecal transplant. Although it does sound a bit gross, of course, because of the culture of how we feel about shit and all that, but but it is so interesting, and it's a testament to science and how we can use our own bodies and things we usually think of as something to get rid of, something that's gross, we need away from us. How can we actually use that for our own good? You know, how can we save ourselves with science, I guess you could say.
That's our question, right? And what I love about this too, there's like economic things too. There are arguments that human feces that can be captured, largely they're talking about this in the development world. Sid Perkins wrote about this in Science Magazine a few years ago. But the idea is that rather than just thinking about excrement as something that goes out and then it'll taint the environment or maybe transmit disease, it can actually be harnessed to heat and power millions of homes. This harkens the idea of why the UN would want to close out open defecation again, because it can be more easy for transmitting disease and can have some environmental impacts. The idea is if we can capture feces deposited in latrines, for example, the sludge can be collected and it can be heated in kilns at temperatures that are super hot, like 300 degrees centigrade or 572 degrees Fahrenheit, which that's more than I usually bake with. It'll create charcoal-like briquettes. And this is kind of crazy, right? You can actually then take these briquettes and then you could burn them like charcoal. And then according to this report that the UN, United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health put out, and that essentially these poop briquettes have the same energy content pound for pound as coal. And that's crazy. So it's like we actually are making our own coal, if you think about it. I know it's obviously a very different thing than coal mining, but if the idea is to get energy, people defecate in certain places, then you capture that, you bake it, and then you have charcoal briquettes. That's pretty interesting. That kind of blew my mind when I read that this is a possibility.
Yeah, I agree. When I read that as well, looking at it, I thought, wow, that's amazing that we could do something like that could be a new energy source, a renewable energy source. That would be amazing. Because we talked about a bit earlier about how our microbiome and our gut collects all the things from our body. And then if we defecate this, and we use the briquettes, turn them into basically human-made coal, our own coal. I wonder how the things that we put in our body might affect the air quality of burning this human-made coal. There was an interesting docu-series on Netflix that I watched. It's called Connected, The Hidden Science of Everything, and it's with Latif Nassar. And he goes with Dr. Leon Barron to the Thames River in London, which is notorious. It's been notorious for centuries for being disgusting and filled with feces. But they took a sample and they found that they could measure the amount of cocaine the city of London was using, and MDMA and other like recreational illegal and maybe not illegal drugs, and things like antidepressants and antibiotics. And I wonder how, if we burn that, what would that do to our air quality? I'm not sure. I mean, better than coal, less great than coal. I'm not sure.
But even linking those, the two examples together, that you can both capture feces, bake it, and then burn it for energy. And then also the previous point you made that we can test the levels of not only pathogens, but in this case, drugs in the water supply through wastewater is super interesting, actually. That, you know, our poop is a record, as odd as that sounds, right? And then what we do with that record after it gets made, do we burn it? Do we bury it? Does it become energy? Does it stay waste? Are intensely interesting questions, right? And especially as we're thinking about the broader implications of climate change, and obviously burning coal is incredibly damaging for releasing atmosphere warming gases. So yeah, I think your question is spot on. Like, does doing something with feces, besides getting people over the ick factor, which I don't think would be that hard, a charcoal briquette in no way resembles a turd, but in the same way that like having a steak doesn't necessarily resemble what you might think of as a piece of a cow sliced off. And so it's like, we're capable of doing that. We're capable of taking something that we think would be disgusting, like watching an animal be cut up, into then having just that piece by itself separated. And so I would be hopeful that this could be something that may offer some solutions of how do we get similar energy needs until we get over some of the political hurdles of finding more renewable sources and scaling those up. But so who knows? Maybe we could all be little powerhouses, right?
I like that idea. Everyone doing their part to be a little powerhouse for the world.
And I think for a final point in this episode, you mentioned this to me, and I'd love you to walk us through a bit of this. Poop in space. We obviously have to go for going to space, but there's really interesting research happening around this also, and this is a little bit out of this world.
So apparently there's actually 96 bags of different kinds of human waste. So not just poop, there's anything from urine, poop, throw up, anything that humans have.
Oh, man. All of it. Okay.
Yeah, all of it. All of it. And it's actually just been left on the moon from various space missions from different astronauts. And we're not sure about this because we haven't gone to the moon in a while, but scientists want to know if bacteria from human waste has survived in these bags. Now, it would be interesting because, of course, they've been in the vacuum of space for several years now. They could be dead by what we know about space. They should be. But if they are not dead, or if they could be reanimated, it would mean that, well, one, some types of life, obviously not humans, can live in the vacuum of space. Also, the idea of panspermia, that life on Earth was created by either a meteor or some kind of space rock hitting Earth, and life and bacteria already being on that rock hitting Earth, and then creating all the life that we are now. And that idea is just so interesting to me. And if bacteria can grow in space, or it can stay alive in some form, or can be reanimated, there is potential that the panspermia hypothesis, that would be great evidence for it, which would be just amazing to know about. Something I am a bit nerdy about. I want to know.
I'm particularly excited about the idea that a bag of shit on the moon is how we're testing the potential of panspermia.
Yeah.
It's like, and so folks, I think that is perhaps the best metaphor we can leave us, right?
Yeah, I agree. Like, a bag of shit can actually be a scientific discovery that could change how we understand life on Earth completely.
No, so I think that's great. And so if we're trying to think about, okay, we're here at the end of the year. We are hoping to put behind us a challenging year. We're excited about what's going to come next. The future seems bright. And I think this is a great way to end us off, that we've gone to space, we've taken a shit there, and we've left it, and it might just tell us if we came from outer space. what more can we ask for, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Liz, thank you so much for chatting. This has been a super fun conversation. It's great to have you on the mic. Let's do it again. And I wish you and all of our listeners a happy New Year's. And here's to health and figuring out all the good stuff that's next, right? To a less shitty year next year.
Absolutely. Happy New Year to you too. And this has been fun.
Cool. We'll see y'all in 2021. You're listening to This Anthro Life, and I'm Adam Gamwell.